You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the show. Stuart Goldsmith here with the Comedians Comedian Podcast, the show that gets inside the mind of your favourite comedians and finds out what makes them tick, whether they're happy or not, what they'd have done differently, and why they're so annoying. But today we have someone wonderful for you, Sean McLaughlin. And I must apologise to Sean for failing to pronounce his name. I had a temporary blip a few episodes ago, and I just seemed to trip over his surname, which is insane. My granny was a McLaughlin many years ago. Admittedly, not a McLaughlin. And the difference is extremely important. Sean is a wonderful comedian. He's done tour support for huge name acts all over the world. He's done Sydney Opera House, Royal Albert Hall, 15 dates in a row at the London Palladium. He's done it all, but we will find out about his journey there, from when he was an angry young man who needed, in Sean's words, either a hug or a slap, and how his comedy has refined over the last 7 hours of his Edinburgh shows. He really is something special, Sean, and it you don't want to say it pains me that he isn't more successful, because I can imagine him listening to this and laughing out loud at that. You don't want to damn people with faint praise. You'll often hear me try and navigate trying to say things like this. I think I know Sean well enough, and by the end of this so will you, to say that it just annoys me that he isn't far more successful, because he's absolutely got this, got the stones for it, if that's not too sexist and gender-based. He is a really, really strong comic. I think in the show notes I describe him as having big chunky stand-up, I went with an interesting moral core. That's true. You can watch his show online. It's called Hail Mary. You can find that free on YouTube. And you can see him at the Pleasance Beneath in Edinburgh at 7:55 daily at this 2022 Edinburgh Festival. The show is called So Be It, and his podcast with Johnny Pelham, also soon coming up on the pod, is called Failing Better. So go to Sean McLaughlin Comedy for everything you need to do with Sean. Follow his socials, etc., etc. But now we are going to get into the transformative effects of being on stage, and indeed those of getting proper therapy. Here's Sean McLaughlin. So welcome to the show. It's lovely to have you on. And I'm properly excited because I have been devouring your stuff of late. And I think you'll know from my giddy texts going, mate, this is fucking brilliant. Mm. I recently watched Hail Mary, which is your show. Which show is that? That's like your most recent. Are you on tour at the moment? What are you doing?
I am.
What's going on?
What's going on? Why have you got the trousers on? Hail Mary was my last Edinburgh hour in 2018. And that toured a bit in 2019 and was then recorded in 2019, which you watched. Mm-hmm. And then I was all set to do a new show in 2020. Pandemic happened. And now I'm doing that show or doing that equivalent show, my seventh hour, this upcoming Fringe, having already done a small smattering of tour dates for it.
Okay, so you're doing the classy grown-up comedian move of Edinburgh is part of the tour.
I think that was the idea, but the problem is a few of the tour dates were moved, and there was only ever a handful there anyway. So I've done a few then. Edinburgh is really when it sort of comes out, and you know most people will see it, and then the proper tour is post Edinburgh.
And what's the show called? What's the Edinburgh show
it's
called?
It's called So Be It.
So Be It. And, yes. Oh, like in Pump Up the Volume.
I don't know if I get that reference.
It's a Christian Slater movie from the 80s.
Oh, great. Okay. Well, sure, like that.
You'll be hearing that a lot, I imagine.
Yeah.
So,
And just while we're talking about Edinburgh, what time and where are you? So this functions in a PR kind of way.
Oh, yeah. I'm on at the Pleasance Courtyard in the Beneath at 7.55.
Nice. Prime time.
I guess so.
Pleasance Courtyard, prime location.
Yeah. I really love that room. It's always been my favourite room to see things in Edinburgh. It's on the sort of left side of the courtyard as you come in.
And you go down the stairs, yeah. And it's like half in the round.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, it's a great room.
I really love it. And it's got air conditioning, and I think everyone I asked...
And it's quiet because it's below the ground.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Everyone who I asked who had done shows there all said it was their favourite room they'd done. And yeah, I'm excited to do it, really.
And what's your... where are you in your comedy career?
Well, I sort of have no idea. I sort of was thinking about that on the walk here because I thought I should probably have some idea. But unfortunately, I don't. I feel like I'm in a nice, sweet spot in that I'm getting to do a lot of different types of gig every week. And I've done a lot of very big gigs and a lot of very small gigs. And a lot of in between, sort of in the last few years. And all of them are sort of legitimate parts of it. And they're all broadly nice. And I just really enjoy being a stand-up, and I enjoy doing the smaller nights, and I enjoy doing the big support stuff. And
you've been doing tour support for a couple of people and doing like massive, like arena tour support.
Yeah, a bit of that. But then I've also been doing, you know, 50 minutes at the end of an open mic night at the fuckle bin.
Yeah.
And I enjoy that all. I've got a nice varied career in terms of comedy, live comedy. And I'm doing more sort of TV writing and other stuff outside of live. So I'm enjoying it at the moment, I think.
And how does that influence the person you are on stage, which is Sean having a massive crisis?
Yeah, it's definitely it's definitely weird, really. I think on stage, I'm a very frustrated version of myself. And I still have those frustrations in my day-to-day life. But I would say the last few years, sort of probably from Hail Mary onwards, the frustrations are not inward as much as they used to be.
Okay.
And then now, I think my act is far more about the outside world as opposed to myself.
Okay, and is that because the therapy that you refer to on stage? Now, I don't know if that was... Did you talk about therapy in Hail Mary, or is that from I Will Prevail?
That's from
I Will Prevail, which was your debut, your second hour.
Second hour, 2014?
Yes.
Oh, did you watch it?
I did watch it. I also saw you in Edinburgh. What show was it that you were at Edinburgh and you were in the... Not the upstairs, but the... like a little...
The Attic.
The Attic.
That was Whatever It Takes in 2015.
So that was your third hour. Okay, so I saw that one live. I Will Prevail, I watched recently. Because you gave me it as a subscriber related some sort of online asset or something.
Oh, I mean, calling it an asset, I think, would be pushing it. It's basically, it was on YouTube. I can't tell if it's a good show or not. I suspect it isn't. I think there's actually good stuff in it.
There's great stuff in it,
but I basically, you can now only see it if you sign up to my mailing list.
Gotcha.
It's sort of a nice little carrot to get maybe a couple more people signed up to that. And it means that people can still see the show who are kind of already...
That's called an asset. That's what an asset is.
Oh, is that what an asset is?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, it's great.
I thought an asset appreciated in value.
Oh, absolutely not.
Oh, all right. Okay,
not
cool.
Necessarily.
Therefore, I am an asset to this podcast.
Not in a digital context. Sure. I don't think they necessarily appreciate value. But if they're drawing followers, maybe they're appreciating it in that kind of way.
Yeah.
But so you talked about going to therapy.
Mm.
And I was really... I'm interested in your... Obviously, it's something that's always on my mind. A thing of this show. It's a okay. pre fucking. We'll cut this.
Prerequisite?
Nathan. No, it's a like something that's always. It's something I
don't think you should
about.
Cut this.
No, come on! It's a fuck set with people shouting it at home.
Are you trying to say pre-cum?
No! It's not. And it's not a preconception. It's a...
Oh, it's predilection?
No, it's fuck me. This is killing me. It's a thing that's always on my mind with this show.
Great.
Which is people's happiness and the effect that happiness and therapy has on the work. And particularly with someone like you, who, as I said, the show I Will Prevail was like, the feeling of that is I will prevail despite everything, or despite myself, or despite the circumstances, the bullying Catholic school people, you know, the kind of all of that, and as you said, as you alluded to in the show, recognizing that depression is anger turned inwards, which is a sort of big facet, a big tenet of therapy. Mm. You seem really fucking angry, and you seem like a lot of that anger was turned in at yourself, and you were not exploiting it, but you were using that. That kind of was the wind in your sails, comically, back then. And then Hail Mary has got sort of energy in it, but it feels like healthier energy.
I'm really glad you said that. That's nice to hear, because I was much angrier in my mid-20s when I was in therapy. I was I guess a bit of a malaise in my life, and my comedy career was sort of, you know, stalling a bit, getting there, I suppose, but I couldn't see the wood for the trees emotionally. And I did funnel all of that into my stand-up. And I don't regret it, because I think it was, you know, they were definitely fun shows to do. Like that I Will Prevail show was, I really liked how it turned out, certainly at the time. But I definitely don't feel angry now in that way. And I feel like, I don't feel angry when I perform. I am passionate. I mean, I'm definitely a passionate person, passionate performer. And maybe I'm loud, and I can see how that could be misconstrued as anger. But I'm glad that you don't think it's still as angry, because I don't. And I think occasionally it gets called that, and I don't mind if they're enjoying it, but I sort of think, oh, but I'm not that angry, really. But I'm definitely passionate. Do you watch The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel?
I have not seen that show.
I really love that show. If there's one lesson from that show, Stuart, it's that stand-up comedy is really easy. So I'd watch it, and I that's how I learned from it. It's actually really easy. But there's a bit in it, I guess it's not really a spoiler, but she's sort of in a relationship with a very tall man at one point. And it's the only time I've ever felt seen in a TV show, is that something bad happens and the tall man goes, I'm trying not to react too much. I'm trying not to show my emotions, because when tall people show any emotion, people always think they're angry. And that's how I feel, because I'm quite tall, and I think people just assume I'm very angry when I'm not.
That's a fascinating observation. I'm sort of rifling through memories to see if I can kind of prove or disprove it. Don't think I can go either way on it, but I accept your...
I mean, I guess I was angry on stage for the first couple of...
You were very angry on stage.
I think definitely the first couple shows I was fucking livid. but you know, within confines. I mean, it was just more like delivering jokes in an angry way.
Yeah, no, for sure. No one came away thinking, Jesus, I hope he's all right.
Yeah, yeah.
It was more just sort of, oh, wow, he's really... I mean, you when you sent me the link, you said, I don't know if I needed a hug or a slap.
Yeah,
I think that was a really funny way of kind of framing it, because then I went into it, watching it, thinking, Sean doesn't know whether this version of Sean needed a hug or a slap. And I'm like, by the end, I was like, I absolutely get why he said that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was, you know, it's a bit... I guess I was 26... when I did that show. It was hard to say where my career or my life was going.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a kind of a scary, weird, angsty time, I suppose.
But there is also, I wonder, an element to it whereby it was a bit like you just protest too much, because you were on stage being very, very funny about what a disaster your life was. And when I see a comic doing that, I always think, yeah, but you're being so funny about it. Surely you know that this is itself is a success. You might be flailing around going, God, everything's a nightmare, but you're doing so in a very successful way. Do you know what I mean? Like, you see someone be that funny about what a disaster their life is, and you sort of think, well, they're going to be all right. Is everybody fucking funny?
Oh, wow. I'm glad you think so. It definitely didn't feel like that, though.
Okay. Okay. And you're right. I mean, I'm like, my knowledge of what Sean McLaughlin is from the outside. I've always heard people go, oh, Sean's fucking brilliant, and then I've seen you be really brilliant and kind of been like, oh, he's really good. We forget that the person on the inside of that circle either isn't being told that stuff, or, of course, it's easy to sort of shuck off your own positive reviews. You know, we don't notice those ones so much.
Yeah, and I guess it's just, I think when you're trying to establish yourself, if you haven't got off to the best start in comedy, which I didn't, you know, it was always fine, but I didn't come close to winning any competitions. I sort of, I didn't
Did you enter? Did you?
I did all of them. I did many of them anyway. I didn't do that many, but I never did. I got to the final of the Beat the Frog World Series and another Northeast regional one.
Okay.
Where there were basically seven people entered and four people got to the final.
Okay.
And that was it. And so I didn't have that. And then, you know, I guess, yeah, I always, you know, it's when you're trying to establish yourself, you don't have that sort of start. There maybe aren't any agents sniffing about. You know, it's that thing where, you know, the career is really long, but it doesn't feel like it's long. And also, I would say at the point, my mid-20s, sort of early to mid-20s, I would say I'd made some severe strategic errors in my personal life. And it was just a lot.
Can you tell me roughly what you're talking about, and not without without wanting to probe too much, what sort of thing do you mean?
I mean, there was nothing bad. It was just I was in a bad relationship, and I didn't have any money, and I was...
Right.
And I'd sort of not done that well at uni, and...
Okay.
And just little things that I thought, you know, you have ideas of what your life will be, and sort of most of them were sort of a bit off.
Okay.
But I, you know, I had stand-up, and I had that outlet, and I did put a lot of care and time into trying... I really wanted to go, I'm going to connect with people, and I'm going to show them how I feel. And, you know, I guess it was pretty angry, but it's okay. I am less angry now, though.
Your kind of origin as a comic... As you depict, or your origin as a person, your school days when you talk about on stage and the kind of the teachers, the kind of Catholic school upbringing and the school reports that you read from, like how much of that was kind of word for word true and how much of like the reports that you read out, did you embellish any of that stuff or was it like that's a true artifact and this is...
I think every single school report was true.
Okay.
I really...
I'm pleased to hear that, because they were... I mean, not for your life, you know, but...
No, wait, actually, I've just remembered, one of the big jokes is one of them's in Spanish, and it's that.
Yeah,
that's not true.
No, that's a very good joke, though, yeah.
But the rest of them...
El Diablo Blanco, yeah, that one, yeah.
Muy loco.
Yeah.
But the rest of them were all true, because I found them. My mum kept them all. I don't know why, but I really, really got off to a very bad start in terms of my relationship with my teachers in school. And it never really, it never settled down. And I don't think I was a bad kid. I was just very, very chatty and full of energy.
Okay.
I certainly wasn't violent or, you know, I didn't skip lessons or stuff.
Do you think they assumed you were angry because you were tall? Like that thing that you were coming back to, if you were animated and tall, do you think it came across as kind of threatening in a way that...
Well, I'd rather... I don't think we should make this entire podcast about how I'm too tall, because I do a podcast with Johnny Pelham where... Every episode is basically him making fun of me for being too tall.
I'm so sorry, I didn't know.
No, it's fine. It probably doesn't help. I mean, I probably got in more trouble than a few of my friends because I stood out more.
Visible, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. I think it was probably just bad luck. It was the wrong form teachers. My form tutor, we all had like, you know, tutors and then you go off to your... It was a state school. It wasn't like it was that alien from what most people have. But my form tutor, the class tutor, was an ex-nun, a very conservative ex-nun who had just got out of the convent, and I think this was her first or second year teaching.
Okay.
And so to most teachers, I was probably a pain in the arse, but nothing serious. But to someone like that, I was probably somewhat of a devil child.
Yeah, okay.
So it was maybe blown out of a proportion a bit, the review. And looking back on it, I do think those school reports... I found them so funny because I thought, well, the work's good, isn't it? Like, I'm not... I don't know. I haven't thought about that routine in a long time, actually.
I suppose what I'm trying to get at is the extent to which it's a reflection of a really tough childhood and the extent to which it was a sort of an angry young stand-up finding... things to be angry about.
I think it was probably more the latter. I mean, I don't view my childhood as tough at all. It was very nice and normal. Very routine in the sort of best sense. And to be honest, I mean, I didn't like school, but I had friends Sure. I enjoyed the social side. I just hated being at school and I hated the teachers and I thought it was... I mean, so that bit's definitely true.
Yeah, okay.
And I guess when you're an adult and you can look back on those things, it's easier to find the jokes in them. I think at the time, yes, my parents probably struggled a bit, but...
Well, it's similar to what you were saying before about, like, you know that a comedy career is a marathon, not a sprint, but at the time, if you don't feel you've got off the blocks... You're just like, is there going to be a marathon? Is it going to continue? Is it going to...
Yeah. I definitely don't think about... I remember being at school and being desperate to get out of there. I was just like, I can't wait till we're not in school anymore. And I think that's a big thing because some people, I think, never, ever like the feeling of not being in school. I think people struggle with it, whereas I just couldn't wait. Because I had all this... I did have a lot of energy and I was always trying to be creative at school. Like, I did drama and English and I loved... writing and I love doing stuff, and I thought, well, when I'm not in this school and in this uniform, that's what I'll be able to do.
Yeah.
And then I started doing stand-up comedy, and turned out it's not creative at all. You're just telling various fingering jokes to strangers, but it's a living, you know.
So this is Sean. Tremendous fun talking to Sean, and he is that brilliant combination of very sort of self-reflective, very, very talented. I cannot wait for you to... This is one of those episodes where I passed the log to Moz, our new ComCom logger, and Moz sent it back in double quick time and pointed out that, wow, I'd never heard of Sean before this, and now I just watched loads of his stuff. So if that is the effect it's having within the organisation here at ComCom... It's not Towers, really, is it? It's a ComCom basement at the moment. Then I hope you have the same reaction. Remember, Sean's show is on at the Edinburgh Festival at the Pleasance Beneath at 7:55. You can get tickets not on an app because the Fringe organisation, in their infinite wisdom, decided not to use the app that everybody expected them to use. I'm choosing my words carefully in case some legal action happens. It won't be from me because I'm only there from the 4th to the 11th, so I've got a smaller horse in the race this time. But you can see A Shared Illusion, which is my work in progress show, at the Monkey Barrel at 1:25 daily between the 4th and the 11th. Go to stuartgoldsmith.com to get tickets for that. And also, there is an alternative to the non-existent app, so I don't know if that makes it an alternative or not, but you can go to planmyfringe.co.uk. There's an Edinburgh Fringe scheduler. You can't buy tickets from within it, but you can find out what's now and next. So have a look at that. Also at Plan My Fringe on Twitter. And I believe some of the free fringe organisations also have their own apps. So look out for those if you're a fan of apps. It is going to be tricky. Do you remember last Edinburgh? I mean, many of you weren't there, but I was. And I remember the weirdest thing was not having one central database of what was on next, because there was no fringe organisation or, you know, it was different at that time. There was certainly no app last year. And I really keenly felt the loss of an app. Because you would come out of a show and go, well, what do? Do I individually check the websites of sort of 15 different organisations to find out what's on next? So if there is nothing else, then Plan My Fringe will have to do. I'm indebted to those of you who sent me your variously data-scraped websites and Excel... Sorry, data-scraped from websites, Excel spreadsheets, which... have given me already a huge case of the panics going up to Edinburgh thinking, oh, really? I'm only there for, 8 days this time and I've got to see 60 shows, so I don't know how I'm going to do that. But enough about that. You can go to comedianscomedian.com/insiders to get hold of ad-free episodes and all the extra content from every show that has it, including, in this case, 25 minutes of extra content, including Sean McLaughlin's reaction to sharing a name with one of the most famous people on the internet. That's very funny. And also, so you can hear his advice on being a tour support when you're, as he has done loads and loads of work, doing tour support for huge names in huge venues. And if you've got any of that coming up or aspire to it, then that might be of interest to you. So that's all in the Insiders Club. And that's all I have to say for now. Let's get back to Sean McLaughlin.
How long did it take for it? Well, what was the bridge in between school and stand-up? Like, how old were you when you started stand-up, and what were the conditions?
I would have been... I was pretty young. I was at uni. I went to uni, and I was desperate to just do stuff and be something. You know, classic Bruce Springsteen I'm going to go out there. I'm going to be somebody. And that it turns out the person I wanted to be was a sad open mic comedian. But I just did. I did a few open mics at uni. Really enjoyed it, and it just sort of snowballed. I remember in third year of university. Early on, it was Chris Martin was was the only other. It was at Newcastle University. Chris Martin, the brilliant comedian, now in LA, and in Coldplay. I remember him saying to me, I think he, because he ran a gig in the uni, and I used to do it occasionally, and he said, do you ever do gigs outside of Newcastle? I went, oh, not really. I'd like to, but I didn't really know how. Yeah. And he sort of said, yeah, you should. And so I started doing more in my third year.
I love those first contact moments when the alien intelligence descends and goes, you realise there's a whole world out there. And you
go,
fuck, what?
I think I knew there was a whole world, but I also, I was having a lot of fun at uni as well. So it was sort of... And maybe I started too young in the sense that I was sort of immediately trying to balance these two. I want to have a very active social life, be at university, and try and be a comedian. But, yeah, it was... let's put it this way. I started doing stand-up when Tony Blair was Prime Minister, and that is a very weird thing for a... it doesn't feel... It feels weird saying that, but, yeah.
Because?
It was just so long ago.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so long ago. But it was, you know, I really... I'd do it again. It's worked out okay.
something's quite interesting, I think, about you and what I've known from you. And we've never done, I don't think we've ever done like a long car journey together on the circuit or anything like that. We've sort of, you know, we've sort of seen each other.
It's sort of passing ship stuff more
But something I suppose my apprehension of you is that...
Your apprehension?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the way I apprehend you, the way I kind of get you without necessarily knowing the details.
I thought you meant like...
Oh, no, I'm
the
not...
The thing you're apprehensive.
No.
The thing that I've taken immediate dislike to, sure.
Well, it's...
Is your height?
It's partly that. It's partly the sort of the quite fun friction between the ferocity on stage, the passion on stage, and the fact that off stage you've always seemed quite sort of like you'd be happy to blend into the background, and you're very kind of like... I think for a while, and we can cut this out if you're not happy with it, but I think you used to not make eye contact with me. Was that a thing? Was that like, I remember you, like I'm sure I had a mate at college years ago who said, oh, I've got this condition where I can't make eye contact with people. And I'd be like, what the fuck is that?
I don't believe you.
But I found that... My interactions with you, I'd always come away going, oh, he seems so awkward because he never wants to look me in the eye.
Yeah, well, I really struggled with it for a very long time, and I had to make a conscious effort to start doing it. I think it's a weird thing
to me as someone who hasn't suffered it and doesn't really appreciate it.
I don't think I knew I was doing it.
Okay.
And I don't think it was, I don't know. I think I struggle to look people in the eye and think at the same time. And now I've sort of developed that skill. But I was pretty awkward and I was pretty shy and...
Yeah.
In many ways, yeah, yeah.
It was the tension between that and who you were on stage I found really fascinating.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I guess it probably was quite a leap. I'm definitely still different. I'm still different on stage than off stage. And I don't know why. I do feel like the on stage. I guess I used to be when I was on stage. I felt like I could let things out that maybe I didn't feel I could in my personal life.
Okay.
But I've got much more confident. I'm better around people. I think I'm maintaining all right eye contact.
Fantastic eye contact throughout.
Let the listener know. Eye contact. No longer an issue.
Sean is under a table and has been the entire time.
But I'm maintaining eye contact.
Well, it was such an unusual thing that I suppose now looking back at it, I kind of... That's why I kind of prefaced bringing it up with, hey, we can cut this, is because I think, oh, is that like a neurodiversity thing or a... But it's just shyness.
I don't think so. Yeah, I don't think it's neuro... I mean, if it is, then...
You have gone without diagnosis.
I've basically cured it on my own. I think I just felt a bit... I was just a bit socially awkward and...
Yeah.
I think I felt a lot of... I think when you first start out in comedy, especially when you start meeting people, like you were a professional comedian and that's what I wanted to be and loads of others. And I just felt a bit, I didn't feel like I belonged there a bit. And,
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I think everyone has that. I felt like the Or someone's goofy cousin that they brought along.
Sure, sure. Know. And probably when I have felt like that, which I certainly have and still in different contexts, I probably cope with it by being a bit giddy and too much out there rather than attractive. Yeah. So sort of same difference, really.
Yeah, yeah.
Was it transformative then to be on stage? Because obviously for people listening to this who aren't comics and who might be shy, the idea of getting on stage and being so vulnerable and being so visible might be anathema to them, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it really was. I mean, I always loved performing, and I loved, I guess I liked sort of showing off and impressing people, and I always wanted to do it. And I think I was, and you know, I think certainly I'd started doing comedy when I was probably a bit too young, but also I don't know if I would have started if I didn't start that young, because I was still full of that sort of teenage desire to do stuff. But because I didn't have that much going on in my life, you know, I didn't really, as I said, I'd made a few errors and things weren't going the way I wanted. Being on stage, I felt like I can connect with people. Like that was how I could, you know, I didn't feel like I had people I could talk to maybe in my life about my issues as much. Okay. But it's also harder when you're younger because everyone's just a bit more insecure and people's lives are changing and growing at different rates. I definitely viewed stand-up as like a way to connect with people that I didn't feel I could in my personal life. I'm saying, but like a lot of things, it is better now. But I think back then, that's probably why I seemed even more angry on stage than I probably even felt. Because I was sort of, I had a lot of stuff built up and I didn't have anywhere else to turn, really.
Yes, that's interesting. I suppose... Something I've only just really started to inhabit in my own comedy is, I mean, over the last 5 years, say, is saying things I actually fucking mean. Do you mean saying things that are important to me? Saying, like, I think one of the big tricks of comedy, and, you know, there's no kind of toolkit because it applies differently to so many different types of people, but to actually say what you actually fucking think rather than either A, what you want them to hear, what you want them to think you think, or B, sort of avoiding things you actually think and just making them laugh with, like, oh, this will be funny and this will make them laugh. That's important too. But actually going, oh, no, comedy is the stuff you should be talking about when they cut the cameras and you go, fucking hell, well, I really think this. And you go, look, that's the thing. That's the bit you should say on stage. And I suppose if any comic feels like they don't have an outlet for their innermost thoughts or they don't have the permission to talk about them or the ears for other people to hear them, then actually it's quite a good way to create quite a passionate stand-up comedian is to go, you can only talk about it under these circumstances.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I just really enjoyed it and I liked, I guess because I'd always been a sort of wannabe artistic guy, I sort of thought, well, this is my self-expression, you know, and because I didn't really feel I did have that option elsewhere. But also it probably meant that I was a bit of a weird fit for pro gigs for longer than maybe I could have been, because it was quite jarring, I think. I think it was maybe, I don't know if it was that jarring, but I didn't have as much control over my performance skills and my emotional skills in terms of writing.
Okay.
Which I think meant that it was a bit, I mean, when it worked, it really, really worked. I think that's what carried me through a lot of years of feeling like it wasn't going anywhere, is when it clicked, being that kind of comedian, I suppose. When it clicked so much.
Yeah.
But then when it didn't, I was like, oh, fuck. I don't, you know. So it was, yeah, I mean, it's always a learning curve, I suppose.
That's really interesting, because I think there are plenty of people doing stand-up for whom, I don't know quite what I'm going to say, but I know what you mean. That thing of when, and I'm seeing you do it, when it clicks and it just, you know, you're really good. You're a really good comedian. You're really passionate. The premises are all really clean and interesting, and like clean in the sense of like lean. I mean, you know, they're and interesting. And you do this thing, which we'll talk about technique in a bit, but you do this thing of like, establish the premise, establish it.
Big,
funny, unexpected punchline. Next. And oh, it's just so fucking watchable. It's great.
Thank you.
Yeah. But so, well, maybe we can get onto that. Well, we'll get to that in just a second. But so when it clicks. And then when it doesn't, you're just sort of like Roadrunner off the edge of the cliff going, whoa.
Early on, definitely. early on. I mean, I think certainly...
Oh, I'm not accusing you of, like, still being unreliable.
No, sure. I mean, as the years went on, I just, you know, eventually you refine it more. I got more comfortable in my own skin. I got more comfortable on stage. And so that meant me... I'm like a well-rounded comedian, I think, now, in a way that I wasn't back then. But also I think it meant that when I went out there and I sort of, you know, I was feeling it, and I was like, God, I just can't wait for this stag do to feel what I'm feeling. And then they don't. And I thought, okay, well, I've basically got one gear. I had one gear for too long, which I think is a problem for a lot of acts.
Yes, 100%. That's very, very astute, yes.
And it depends, and that's not a problem. It's natural to have one gear. It's probably healthy to have one gear for a while, because it means you're trying something, even if it's failing. But then when that one gear is, I'm 100 miles an hour, I'm gonna shout at you about all the things I hate about my life, and that doesn't work, I would go into the audience a lot.
Yeah.
Sort of as a newer act, I wasn't scared of going into the audience a lot, because I was up there thinking, I was so desperate to make this work in the moment. And I guess the problem is inexperience means you make a lot of mistakes, particularly with audience interaction. But I probably took the scenic route in terms of getting that kind of club ready, a level of sort of polish on me. I probably took longer than I needed to, but I feel that about most of my career.
You took, and why is that? You took longer than you needed to because...
In terms of my career, and I think they're linked, aren't they? I think I was, we sort of said I wasn't the most confident person in the world. I was scared of asking for gigs a lot of
big
the time.
Thing. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so I was doing a lot of gigs, but I was kind of doing the same bunch of gigs.
Yeah.
I was sort of in that netherworld between being a good open mic and a kind of 50 quid semi-pro person for a very long time.
Okay.
Because of that, and then I thought if I get an agent, that'll sort me out.
Yeah.
And then they all saw me and sort of liked it, but none of them said yes, certainly not then. And so I think that's why it took longer. And then, but then, you know, my life got a bit better. Things got a bit better. I just got better as a comedian. And as such, it sort of started figuring itself out, I guess.
What was the first bit that you did that clicked every time?
Well, that's a really good question. I don't know. I mean, it's so interesting. When I start at... You talk about bankers, don't you?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You talk about bankers. Do you remember that phrase?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's a banker.
Yeah.
And it's like...
That really reminds me of, like, Christian Knowles, Boat Show.
That's like, yeah, yeah,
2005.
Yeah.
Get your bankers out, yeah.
Get the bankers out. And I think that was all anyone ever wanted was a banker.
Mm-hmm.
It's pre-2008, you know. Actually, I suppose slightly post-2008. But, it was, I sort of look back at like the early days. My idea of what a banker was a joke that worked sort of 6 or 7 times out of 10.
Yeah,
I go, that's a banker.
Yeah. And then, a contextual banker.
Yeah. And then now, my idea of a banker is terrorists have a gun up to my wife's head and I have to make them laugh. Yeah. That's a banker.
Yeah.
So it's hard for me to remember. I talked a lot about being skint early on. And I remember that got a reaction in audiences that was sort of consistently good.
Yeah.
I had good jokes about being skint. Because I was just, you know, trying to be a comedian, working in a call centre. So, you know, it was fine. It wasn't, it wasn't impoverished, but I didn't have money to go on holiday or do anything. I was just sort of travelling on mega buses around. So I think it was probably that. That was like a kind of a calling card, I suppose.
Yes, yes. And it's one of those, what you've keyed into there is, I'm failing. I'm flailing.
Yeah,
this
yeah.
is who you. So this is who you're presenting to the audience is. I'm a disaster.
Definitely,
I fucked this up.
Definitely, definitely. And I think, I mean, that's definitely how I felt. yeah. as well, if I'm honest, for a lot of it.
So it resonated.
Yeah,
so
it really,
was like, we all looked at it and went, this is a true thing. Yeah.
Yeah. I definitely wasn't a dead behind the eyes, rabid madman. It was, yeah.
Like eating, I remember the line about eating porridge with a key or something. Do you know what I mean? Mm. Kind of like that, very fun, florid language.
Yeah.
About hating everything and hating Brighton and hating, you know, I'm sort of trapped somewhere. I've trapped myself. It's my fault and I'm failing.
Yeah,
that was the sort of foundational premise.
There was, yeah. And there was definitely, people who I think really liked that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I was able to get, you know, some okay bookings. And eventually, you know, I did get an agent off the back of that stuff. And, you know, I thought it was okay stuff. It was definitely scrappy. It was definitely rough around the edges.
Yeah. But then that's not necessarily bad. I mean, it's not great for telly, but actually rough around the edges is great in a club. Because it feels rich and honest and like a real thing. It doesn't feel shiny and manufactured and a product.
Oh, 100%. I mean, I'm sure there were gigs I had back then that were better than any gig I could have now. Like, I'm sure. But I'm also sure there were as many of those that were just so... It was like an error. I would be up there going, it is a mistake that I'm doing this gig.
Let's just kind of get sort of to take the emotive stuff out of it. Like, sure. How bad were the deaths? How frequent were the deaths? Were you just going around dying all over the place? Or was it just that... Was it like a head job you were doing on yourself going, it was actually a fine gig, you got away with it, but you come off feeling like hell? That's a thing.
That's
a thing I can imagine you doing. You know?
Yeah, it was probably more that. I mean, it's hard to really... It's hard to remember. I'm so different from the person I was back then. And my life, you know... And it was a long time ago, I guess. I think... When I died, I really died.
But
I didn't die so often.
Yeah.
It was always going well enough to... It was going well enough to justify me not quitting. And never that well enough to justify anyone thinking, well, here's someone we should invest money and time into.
Sure.
I was just sort of... I think it was such a slow incline. Is that the right phrase? Like the ascent.
Mm.
Like, I look back now and I think I was getting better, and the career and the sort of turning it into a life was happening, but it was happening, it was going up at such a tiny pace that it sort of felt like nothing was happening.
Mm-hmm.
But, some of the deaths were bad. I mean, I remember walking out of there are some gigs I remember walking out of, and the audience were talking about me and they didn't know I was behind them. And I was like, oh, fuck, this is not. But there were also times when it was mad. Like, it was just what they needed. The stars aligned.
Yeah.
And those sort of gigs really carry you through, especially if you've got a bit of self-doubt and you're not sure if comedy's the right thing. Those just, I mean, the highs you feel when back then, nothing's better than that.
I remember trying to... I think we all have that sensation of, like, I wish I could bottle this feeling. I wish I could remember how I feel about myself right now and just put it in a bottle and just drink a little bit every so often and go, this self. Superhero self.
Yeah, yeah.
The right guy for the job in the right time with the right... And I've earned all of it.
Yeah.
And it's my clever thoughts and my timing and it's mine, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I remember vividly, this was like a big moment, as I was working at a foreign language school in Brighton, and I was doing a barbecue on a Friday for some... foreigners, I guess, who were learning English in the school, because I was like the events coordinator, so I'd like basically be in charge of making sure none of like the Italian teenagers, I don't know, fell in the Thames or whatever. And I remember I got a message from the Bracknell Comedy Cellar. Do you remember?
Brilliant gig,
one of the best gigs. And they said, oh, they need a middle spot, and it's £100. Can you do it today? And I was like, yeah, I could do it. And I remember going there, walking from the station, basically through a motorway to the venue. And I think it was the first time I'd ever done a fully pro bill,
okay,
where everyone was doing 20. And I did the middle 20. And I had a recorder on my phone. My phone was like a shitty sub Nokia 3210, but it did have a recorder on it, but it only lasted 5 minutes. You could not record more than 5 minutes. And I did the gig, and it went so well. Like, I would still probably put it top 10 gigs maybe I've ever had. And I remember just like running back to the station afterwards and listening to that first 5 minutes of my set again and again and again. And that's the feeling that you get when you start, and when it works. And God, I still love stand up, but nothing's better than those early years. I mean, do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think
nothing,
so.
Nothing's as good as that.
Now I'm satisfied, and sometimes I'm wholly satisfied. Yeah, I did wonderful gig. I did a couple of gigs last night. The last one I did was wonderful. Mm. Weird circumstances. It was to date it, if you were there, it was the Sofa So Funny gig. It was just like an incredibly warm on-site audience of, I'm going to call you fans, but also it's like a fans with whom I have a funny tension whereby they bully me and I'm far enough away from it emotionally. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was just an oddball gig where I was fucking good, and I've got a lovely warm feeling about that now, and it makes me feel good to remember it. But largely, I don't run around in circles anymore after a good gig. I go, I am wholly satisfied with that. What a, you know, and I don't, deliberately, I'm not contriving it, but it's like, I just feel in a mature, you know, professional comedian's way, yep, good.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's lovely. That's a very satisfying feeling, and it feels calm and measured and less like my life is this insane roller coaster that it used to be of absolute self-absorption and God, I'm wonderful, to absolute despair at something going wrong and crying in a car park afterwards, you know.
Yeah, that's it.
Like, I've been on those tracks, not always, but there was definitely elements of my career where, you know, I'm ashen.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, 100%. But I definitely, when you see the other side of that sort of insane ebb and flow, I'm really grateful I had that period of my life in a way. Because I really loved it. In a way, I don't know if it's still possible for me to love it as much as that. But I loved it so much. I was so desperate for it. I was too close to it. I mean, that's the bottom line. I was too close to it. And now it's like, oh, I've done I'm a professional.
Yeah.
And great, love it.
I did what was expected of me to a high standard.
Still love it.
Yeah.
Still great feeling. When you have a new bit and you get it working,
that's always the best bit, isn't it?
Brilliant.
I talk about that constantly.
Yeah,
the bit, you have a new idea, or you say a third thing, you improvise a third thing or a tag or something, and you go, and you just touch the magic thing.
And I guess it's pretty rose tinted. I guess you're allowed to romanticise your own past if you want. But I sort of had that feeling all the way through, even my first couple Edinburghs, because I really genuinely felt like, for a lot of it, I was like, this is not going to happen. This is just not going to happen. I'm not suited to this life. I'm not suited to this industry. But the highs, I focus on the highs more than the lows now, which is probably healthier. It's probably better. Yeah.
I can't remember which show it is. Yes, I can. It must be from I Will Prevail. You talk about husks. You
husks.
Talk about other comedians being husks. Not all other comedians, but certain other comedians being husks in a dressing room. People who are bitter, who are banging on about bitterness and the things that didn't work out for them.
Yes, I remember that. Because a lot of that show was about how I think I need to quit comedy.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
I remember that.
Yeah, you were talking about your relationship. Your partner was in the comedy industry.
And
there's a lot of stuff about, I don't know what I'm doing and why.
And
ways in which, when I ever write jokes about, or if I am kind of trying to express something about my place in comedy or my ideas about my own career or anything like that, I always worry that it's like it's too inside baseball, or it's too, do you know what I mean? It's too self-absorbed.
Of course.
You've got to try and phrase it in a way, or make it wear clothes where it's about ambition that everyone can relate to and stuff. But equally, sometimes I just really like hearing a comedian talk about what it's like being a comedian. It's all allowed, isn't it?
Well, yeah, and I guess I did that a lot in my early years. And I always thought it wasn't too inside baseball. It probably was, maybe. But, you know, the thing is, I think people in general are interested in show business. That's kind of how
I'd love to think that you always pronounce it like that.
Show business.
Show business.
people are very interested in this business that I call show.
And other people call it that too.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I did. Well, I guess I was at that stage in my life where I was like, fuck it. It's just... because and I think that's another frustrating thing maybe at that time. You meet comedians who just hate being comedians.
Yeah.
You go, well, what? Yeah. And then you become one of them. And you go, all right, now I get it.
Let's talk about your... let's talk about some of your jokes, because you've got such good jokes. You've got such a turn of phrase, and you've got such a good, like, it just feels like a joke ready imagination. Do you know what I mean? So do you feel that, do you feel you had kind of a natural predilection, was the word I was looking for? do you feel that you had a natural predilection for thinking in funny ways, or is it something that you kind of taught yourself to use funny ideas in the pursuit of saying what you wanted to say?
Well, I was always, I always loved comedy, and I was always trying to make funny things and write funny things.
What comedy did you love?
As a kid?
Yeah.
I think when The Simpsons started showing on the BBC, that was probably the biggest moment of my life.
Yeah.
I remember I couldn't really believe that I was laughing at something and my mum was laughing at it. And so The Simpsons was my favourite.
That ruined my mate Hutch's life, because he had Sky, so everyone thought he was really witty, and then suddenly we realised he'd been cribbing it all off The Simpsons.
You don't work at a power plant at all. and I loved, like, comic strips. I loved Garfield.
Oh, yeah. Comics. I thought you meant the comic strip, like the things like that date.
Oh, no. I meant like newspaper comic strips. And actually, that was something I really wanted to do for a while. And I used to try and draw them. So, those were kind of, in a way, that's probably sort of subconsciously harnessed a sort of joke craft.
Yes, okay.
Before that.
Three panels. We've never talked about that on the podcast.
Set up, establishing, the punchline. Yeah, that was.
It's only just a kid. Have you ever seen Garfield without Garfield?
Yeah, God, I love it.
Absolutely brilliant. Of course, you love it.
It's brilliant.
You're very you.
It's so funny.
It's just occurred to me you could do the same thing with a stand-up. You could edit. Can someone get on that? Can someone get a huge Burr routine and just leave in the premises and then the punchlines? It would look so mad. Sorry, tangent.
No, I agree. So I guess there was that, but then you do stand-up and. And you just have to figure out how to do it and how it works for you and stuff like that. And it becomes a sort of holistic thing of your joke writing and who you are, and sometimes they don't match up and you have to make them match up. So I guess I definitely learned on the job. I feel like I loved comedy and was trying, so I guess maybe I was always trying to do it. But it's not like I rushed out the gates when I started stand-up. So.
were you, like, how dense was your kind of writing? Like, just from a joke from I Will Prevail, you talk about someone asking you, are you renting or buying? And your punchline of it is, I'm more likely to win the Grand National as a horse than get a mortgage. And that, the as a horseness is just one of those lovely kind of, whoop, like there's the joke, and then it's not even a topper, it's just the most functional component of the joke is a skying off to the left idea. Like, in it, and you're really good at those. You're really good at like a really a super abrupt kind of punch into like a 90 degree turn.
Oh, that's nice. I guess so. I think
that's one of the reasons I enjoy your stuff, because as comics we often know what's coming, and with you I don't know what's coming, and I love that, because it's not so obtuse, it's not surreal, and the audience can't follow it. It's just that if you can make the comics laugh as well rather than instead of, then you've got a good game in terms of surprise, like the right thing that's surprising in the right way.
Oh, that's nice to hear. I mean, I think one thing about me that maybe hopefully stopped me being just another ranty, angry comedian is I'm very silly and I love silly things.
Yeah.
And so, like, The Simpsons is really smart and it's really dumb. And, like, I love 30 Rock. It's probably my favourite sitcom. And I think I love those sort of jokes. And I think it's better... it's almost funnier when someone is really passionate and doing those sort of things.
Yeah. Like, what's the starting point for a stand-up? If you think of, like, your newest bit, and I realise you're sort of on tour at the moment, but your newest idea for a bit that isn't quite a bit yet.
Yeah.
Like, what do you do with it? What are the tools with which you try and...
Usually, I walk around my house talking to myself a lot. I'll just talk to myself a lot.
I love it. So few people admit that.
Yeah, I do it. And I
Rod Gilbert laughed at me for asking that. And then it turns out he goes on long walks and turns out...
Yeah, definitely. But no, I do that. I sort of... I just sort of talk to myself and pretend I'm on stage and try and find the angle in.
It's weirdly useful, isn't it? I find it like I don't do... I feel like I don't do that as much as I should.
Whenever I don't do it as much as I used to, and whenever I do... I think, well, this is obviously the best technique for me, so why am I wasting my time going to a coffee shop with a laptop, pretending I'm a Sex and the City girl when I'm not? I'm a man who sits with the curtains shut at home, rambling to himself. But
That doesn't feel like a day's work, does it? But it's the most... If it produces the results, then it's the day's work.
I find it interesting. I feel sometimes if I hit something, if I get excited about one thing I say, you never get that moment of being on stage... off stage, the adrenaline that makes you think better. But I get a kind of maybe substitute sometimes, and it sort of other ideas carry on after that first one. I guess it's about sort of trying to build up even a tiny smidgen of adrenaline, or sort of that whatever that spark is.
But in the canter,
in a kind of controlled environment. And then I sit down. I don't write on my laptop much anymore because I get distracted. But I write it out in my notepads. You know, I'll rehearse it a lot, and then I'll go on stage and I'll say it totally different because I realise, or in the moment I think I've got the wrong wording.
And it just solves itself because they're there and it's magic.
Yeah. I mean, really, it's so inconsistent. Sometimes it's perfect first time, exactly as I wrote it, and sometimes it takes a million tries. And sometimes it's obvious what the solution is. And a lot of time, there is no solution. Straight in the bin. But that's how
Tell me about the rehearsal. When you say you rehearse it, do you mean you kind of practice, like you word the joke, and then you change the walking around in a darkened room from being a creative thing to being a rehearsal thing? So you just say it loads of times?
I guess it's not... I mean, calling it rehearsal maybe isn't the right phrase. I guess it's getting... I want to get comfortable with the idea of saying it.
Yeah.
So when I, you know... Even if it's just a couple times. But I'm much better now at living in... I don't do that as much as I used to. I think because I'm maybe naturally better on stage than I used to be. I can write stuff on the train or the tube to the gig.
That magic hour before the show, when it really matters.
That's the thing, isn't it? I'm worried about... You know, I'm not worried about Edinburgh. I think it will be okay. But I'm sort of at that moment where I'm going, 7 weeks till the... as of recording, it's 7 weeks till the Fringe. And I, you know, it's good. You know, I think at least there's loads of good jokes in it, but I know there's a few more gears to go through. But I guess it's an experience thing now where I go, the closer it gets, the more I panic and the better I work. I mean,
Lovely to be experienced enough to realise that that's the case. I remember I had a very clear memory of... doing my first Edinburgh show, realising I had to write another one, you know, like the second show thing, and going, oh God, and having the thought, oh no, I've given myself homework forever.
Yeah.
Like I've probably said this on the show before in the very early days of it, that feeling like you could be stranded on a desert island or on a bus teetering on the end of the cliff. You could always be thinking about jokes.
The
material's all there in your head. The tools are all there, so you're never allowed a break from it. And actually, a much more mature way of thinking about that is, no, when it gets near to go time, I'll suddenly become better at it, and I'll do it then, an extent.
That's not to say I don't bang my head against a wall on a weekly basis, frustrated that I can't write anything. I mean, I certainly, because I had a little bit of an early deadline with a few tour shows pre-Edinburgh, which I'd never had, I was in sort of pre-Edinburgh mode in February.
Yeah,
I was stressed out and I was worrying a lot, and I was, you know, throwing loads of mud at the wall at gigs and seeing what stuck. And I'll be there again in 4 weeks. I'll be exactly there. I know it. I'll, but at least I'm used to the feeling more.
When you say you'll be exactly there, like it'll be finished and ready and you're ready.
No, I mean, be exactly there emotionally as I was
in the same place before every other
Edinburgh. But, you know, with, I think, a little bit more experience, a little bit more craft, which makes it a little bit less frantic and painful. But my heart always goes out to people. I just, whenever people are stressed about Edinburgh, I just go, yeah, it's, it is really hard. It'd be weird for it not to be hard.
When you're in writing mode or stomping around or pre-gig mode, what are the worries that you encounter? Like, one of you mentioned your seventh hour. I think I've done ten.
Yeah.
And before every single one of them, at the beginning of the process, I've thought, I've got nothing left.
Yeah.
So that's one of my repeated, that's one of my core beliefs.
Sure.
I've got nothing left.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
I know
yeah.
that's not true. Logically, it's nonsense. But I feel it every time. What sorts of equivalents of that do you have to overcome, if any?
Well, that, I mean, I just want it to be really good. I just want to put on the best show I can, and that's it. And I feel like I don't want to let my audience down. These people have come out, especially if they already know me. You know, I want it to be better than the last one, or at least as good.
It's a good show title. At least as good as the last one.
It's at least as good as the last one. It's actually, hey, yeah, why not?
Have they always been better? Have you managed to maintain an upward trajectory? If you look back at your last seven shows, do you feel like, oh, that was the blip year?
I don't know. I would say I think they've all been good. I think some of them, to 2015 show that you saw in the attic, that's the one I look back on and think, my lack of skill as a performer let me down. Because actually I thought that was a lot of good stuff there. I thought it was the only time I've done a show that I thought was beyond my skills.
Yeah.
And actually if I'd shown a bit more restraint and if I just had a bit more about myself as a performer, but even then it did fine. I mean, it was all, you know, in Edinburgh they're always steady. I've had good Edinburghs. I'm not happy with any of them. It's not like I look at them and go, they were all perfect.
But are you not happy with any of them? Are you surely you're like,
I'm happy with a few of them.
Yeah.
But it's not like I look at every one and just go, well, these are all pristine, perfect, precision engineered shows.
Yeah.
They all have flaws and I'm aware of the flaws.
What sorts of flaws do you find yourself noticing in your work, not necessarily in your Edinburgh shows, but what are your flaws? What things do you have to routinely overcome?
Well, doing new stuff, swearing a lot, swearing too much through nerves. Got to nip that in the bud.
Yeah, true.
Because swearing is really funny in the right place, and so not swearing when it's not the right place ruins that.
Yeah. I've got a really good punchline that's for fuck's sake at the moment, and I'm trying to change it to for Christ's sake, and it's just not as funny, but I have to.
It's hard, isn't it? I've got a bit where the swearing isn't even part of the thing. It's not even that. I say the word broom, and it works. If I say fucking broom, it flies. So that's one I go, well, that one has to be a swear.
Okay.
And so cut out a few of the others.
You've got to cut one from previous, yeah.
That's a lot. I mean, just in general, just forgetting why I'm up there sometimes. I think this is all in terms of doing new stuff. In terms of finished, honed stuff, I always just think there's probably a couple routines in all the shows that aren't as good as the others, and I could have just lost them and brought in better. Just having stuff that could be better.
That awful thing in October when you do a long set and you do 40, you do that like Comedy Box or something, it's 45, and you just do the best bits of your Edinburgh show, and you go, oh God, I wish I'd done this, and then written another 15 minutes. Like, do you mean, like, do you find yourself doing that? I have observed this of myself many times.
100%.
I'm inflating it to get to an hour, and it does work, and it is an hour, but if I only had to do 45 minutes, it would be better.
Well, I've done, on the tour so far, And this is sort of, I agree with you, but I'm having an even greater crisis with it. Not crisis, but I've done an hour and a half every on the tour show. First tour show, I did an hour and 40. Mm-hmm. And they've been, certainly the Manchester date was probably the best solo show I've ever done. And I thought, what? At the point, I suppose the logic was, but by then, there'll be no reason to preview for Edinburgh because you'll have an hour and a half and you'll just cut that down.
Oh, yeah.
But the problem is, I don't think it's... I still think there's 40... I think a lot of it is really good and fine, yeah. But there's still more stuff for me to write. So I'm cutting it down and adding to it at the same time.
Yeah, that's hard. That's one of the points at which my writing risks spiralling out of control, when I've got too much to work on in one go. Like, I've got all of this. This is the bones of a show. But what I need to do now is a series of precise jobs where I fix that bit, drill into that bit, get rid of that bit, but instead I just look at the whole thing and then end up tweaking a bit that I like tweaking.
That's exactly how I feel. And I think I'm probably... I mean, it's the show as it stands, I mean, it's good. The solo shows I've done have been really fun. It's probably not going to change anyone's life, but it's not going to ruin anyone's night. But I try and keep that in mind, and I've got plenty of time to work on it. But it is a frustration. It gets a bit easier, but it doesn't get that much easier. This, I suppose, in my experience, anyway.
What's an example of a thing, a thought you've had, or a joke that you cannot make work? Have you got anything that readily to mind?
I've got a huge chunk that was going to be in the show that I haven't put in, and the only way I can make it work is by explaining I've never been able to make this work. But the problem is the idea is I actually think now the idea is too. I don't view it as objectionable or offensive, but that's how it's always going to be taken, and so I don't even bother. It was one that, let's put it this way, if there was no pandemic, it would have gone in this show.
Gotcha, okay.
Because I was doing it a lot, and yes. I know there's something there.
And the fact of the pandemic has changed how people react to it?
Well,
it's very hard to do jokes about old people dying now without it having a different...
100%. It's very hard to do. All my bat-eating gear is unfortunately been thrown to the curb. It was, I mean, I had a big chunk about sort of a financial... about the 2008 financial crisis about... this is sort of the topic. Was like, we don't really talk about it anymore, even though it's probably the biggest thing that ever happened to us. And now it isn't.
Yeah.
You know, now we've got an equivalent financial crisis on top of a health crisis. But in terms of other stuff, I mean, I so many ideas. Still, I mean, I'd say my hit rate now, in terms of what works, in terms of what I think of, is probably... 50%, that seems high.
Mm.
But I'm still... I mean, killing my darlings on a weekly basis. Your listeners might hope they understand that's a writing phrase. But yeah, it's all trial and error, trial and improvement still. I write a load of jokes. Some of them work, some of them don't. And then I cut the ones that don't, and I write more that work. It's harvest, you know? It's like I'm like a farmer.
Tell me about your podcast briefly. All I know about your podcast with Johnny Pelham is that you read each other's self-help books. Is that the
bridge
that? Because honest concept I wish I'd fucking thought of. Someone told me about that. I was furious. I was like, oh, God, that's a good one.
Oh, really? Oh, that's nice. Well, I mean, you'll be pleased to know that we've absolutely knocked on the premise justice. I do a podcast with Johnny Pelham. One of the best, most underrated comedians on earth.
He's fantastic.
And one of, unfortunately, the biggest idiots on earth. But Johnny's sort of... we've always been good friends, and we sort of... kindred spirits in a way. Not really, but in a little way. I should not say that. But, he's really into self-help stuff.
Mm.
And so we're very similar types of personality. Like, we sort of catastrophize and sort of, we always talk about how we're losers and we laugh a lot whenever we meet up. But he's really into self-help, whereas I'm not in the slightest. And so we sort of doing a podcast about self-help. And each week we sort of cover a different angle of it, or sometimes we get guests in and try to teach us and make us better. But it's like a lot of those podcasts where it's sort of an excuse to hang us trying to be funny and stuff. But actually, we did a two-part episode about Paul McKenna with confidence that was really all we talked about was the stuff. And then we did a hypnosis CD together.
Yeah.
In the second half. And I really did feel something.
Ah.
And it was the only time. And unfortunately, Johnny felt nothing, and so I was the joke of the episode. But I mean, are you a self-help person? Have you subscribed to it?
Yes. Maybe less so than I have been now, just because I think I've put a lot of it in practice and it's helped. Mm. So I don't spend so much time with it. But I like the idea of it. I mean, this podcast is arguably, it has a sort of self-help component. I'm really fascinated with, it started off, how do you write your jokes? And now it's, how do you cope with the challenges of a creative life?
Of course.
And so I'm really interested in, like, what do you say to yourself in this particular instance? When it goes badly, what does that feel like? What do you say to yourself? Yeah. Like, I've already asked you, what worries would you have when you write new stuff? So I'm really interested in solutions to those things. And a lot of them I use, and I've used them and put them in my life so much that they're not, those problems aren't really problems anymore.
Yeah, I guess.
But
that,
having said that, there are still big anxieties I have, which I just can't shake off, that affect my life. They're just, I understand it, I've looked at it from all angles, still feel it. Ah, fuck.
We're emotional creatures. And that,
you and I particularly.
Well, I think we probably both are. We're probably more on that end. I don't mind that. And I am, I'm sensitive and I'm all those things. But it's funny talking about the creative life, because me and Johnny sort of talk about that sometimes, and it's whenever I listen to this podcast, which I don't listen to all the time now because I'm trying to not have comedy in my life.
Yeah,
but that's the bit that's when it gets weird, this job, because I think it's, I've got a wife, I have a really nice life. I'll pre-answer by saying I am very happy. I'll sort of pre-answer.
Nice move, no one's ever done that.
I'm very, very happy. I really feel, I sort of can't believe my luck. And at some point it will change. And, my wife's from another country and things are, who knows where life's going. And ultimately doing this job, I think there does reach a point, maybe for a lot of people, if you want to keep everything in your life going. You've got family. I've got a family, but I've got friends. A lot of my friends aren't in comedy. I come from a big family. I go see my wife in Canada, her family, and we want to travel and the stuff we want to do. And being a comedian is a perfect conduit for that in many ways, until it stops being that, and then you deal with it. And there's no answer. The answer is become really rich and successful and do it on your own terms. But that's not an option for most of us. So it's interesting. But I guess that's, you almost need to have another podcast that's just about that, isn't it? Like, we've covered the onstage, now we need to cover the offstage.
The offstage, how do you mean?
I think, like, this conversation we've got in between, my onstage and my offstage. But sort of increasingly, my offstage life is sort of more... I certainly care so much more about that than I do about comedy. It's not to say I don't care about... I care about comedy as much as I did. It's just I now have other stuff I also really care about. So it's interesting.
That's great. And I think you're a great advert for therapy, right? Was it the therapy that helped with this or other stuff? Like, given that it was, 10 years ago, 8 years ago?
Well, I was on antidepressants for many years after that.
Okay.
And the thing is with my therapy is he was a trainee, and I have talked about this in the podcast with Johnny. My last session, he basically told me he was in love with me and sexually attracted to me, so it sort of did undermine it a bit. But
I'm so sorry that that incredibly unprofessional thing.
Well, he wasn't a professional,
yeah.
So I guess you can't even. But no, I mean, it's
open mic therapist.
I think heck of a bucket speech.
Jesus, that. Let's just underline for the sake of the listener that absolutely shouldn't ever happen.
Well, it's probably
that's an enormous betrayal of your trust and incredibly unprofessional.
It took me about 5 years to realise that was a problem, because I had no confidence. I was like, I guess that's just the way adults are, telling people they love each other. Fair enough. I guess I'm an advert for. I think I'm just an advert for just keeping going and
But it was
just taking control. Like, it, eventually, even a Weasley, you know, wet dog like me was able to get better people in my life, get rid of people that weren't as good.
Well, that's it. That's what I mean. And you've done just the right things.
So far. We'll see. Who knows? Maybe I'll have a bad review first day of Edinburgh and I'll just be sniffing glue under a bridge. But we'll see.
So that was Sean. Great having Sean on the show. One of those people. And there are still many. I can't believe I've done 400 and something episodes over 10 years. And there are still people who I get to and think, Christ, why haven't I done them before? So you'll be pleased to know that the Comedian's Comedian podcast will continue in perpetuity until I die. And I really must get round to recording some sort of mawkishly sentimental message to be listened to you, to be put out on the feed by Nathan in the event of my demise. Why would I even mention that? That's a passing thought. It's not even a tweet. Certainly don't start announcing my impending demise. I've heard nothing. That's not on the basis of anything. I've heard nothing. What's that? Is that from the first Hot Shots movie? Like, how are you, Captain? Why? What have you heard? Anyway, so that was Sean. You can see him, as I mentioned before, at the Pleasance Beneath at 7:55. Don't miss that show. It's going to be brilliant. He is brilliant. Find his stuff. Find Hail Mary online or everything else at SeanMcLaughlinComedy.com. Go to the Insiders Club for all the extra bits. They are particularly fascinating this time. And next week, I can't tell you now because we're at the end of the ones that are in the can. I've got two very, very exciting guests coming up soon, and I have been privileged to listen to both of their previews for this coming festival. They're both going to be great. I will get them out to you as soon as I can. And for now, that does us. I'll have a brief post amble at you in just a second, but first, let's thank Nathan Wood for podcasting. Let's just thank Nathan Wood for podcasting. Let's thank Moz for logging and also embarking on his own stand-up journey, which I don't know whether or not I'm allowed to tell you, so keep that to yourself. Also, thank you to Rob Smouton for the music, podcast consultant Peter Dobbing, and Brett Goldstein just for that tremendous jawline. Eh? Thank you and goodbye from me. StuartGoldsmith.com for links to Edinburgh and also ComediansComedian.com for all the other stuff. Although I'm thinking of breaking the website now to see if it has an effect and replacing it with something on Wix using an app called ElfSight, which I put in my diary, and it looks like my wife shares my diary, and it looks like a coded message. It looks like an easily breakable coded message for me sneaking in some extra D&D time. But it isn't. It's an app. All right, darling? So there we go. It's all about the app at the minute. This post amble will be about apps. Here's some of the things that are being said in the Facebook group, because I think this is fascinating. Obviously, we find out there isn't an app. Everyone feels cheated. The Live Comedy Association is activated and a staggering number of signatories get in touch within 24 hours. When you sign it, you see all the people that are signing. You're like, holy shit, this is why the LCA exists, right? This is like a look at all of these people that are brought to bear on this organisation. And if you don't know much about the Edinburgh Festival, in my opinion, over 28 plus years of going, it seems to me that the fringe organisation exists to facilitate the work of the people who perform the shows in the fringe. And there seems to be a sort of an uneasy relationship between those it is facilitating and the way in which it facilitates them. You might remember my show Prick in 2000 and... God, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know, a long time ago. But the title was censored. I had to change it to PR exclamation mark CK. Because they decided they wouldn't let me have that title. Or more recently, John Luke Roberts wanted to do, I think, and this is my interpretation of events rather than anything he said to me, but it seemed like he wanted to have a title that had emojis in it and wasn't allowed. So there is this sort of weird relationship where you go, okay, they have a style guide and I understand why they have that, but if they exist to facilitate the artists should be able to do whatever they want without being told, no, that's not allowed. You can't have an open access arts festival and then tell people things aren't allowed. But maybe it's not possible to administrate an open access arts festival if every fucker is coming up with stupid titles based on emojis and sound effects and interpretive dance in an attempt to perhaps to stand out. So how do you square that circle? God knows. I'm glad it's not my responsibility. When I saw yesterday that the app, and this will be old news now because this episode won't go out for a couple of weeks, but I saw yesterday that the that there was no app, and howls of outrage, totally understandable. I have a smaller horse in the race this time. I'm only doing a week. And to be honest, the fewer people see it, the better. But you can't say that because you definitely want people to come and see it. But the room is too big, as I pointed out, and it would have made much more sense in a 30-seater. But nonetheless, here we are. So, outrage at the lack of an app, and people going, hang on, I've paid for this, which they absolutely have. Everyone paid with the expectation of it, regardless of the sort of, oh, there's an alarm. Everyone paid with the expectation of an app. There is this increasing tension between the amount of money people pay in order to go into a brochure, which no one in my, I mean, I don't even look at it anymore, because why would you look at a printed brochure? One would imagine that the value to the fringe organisation of having a printed brochure is that they can sell loads of advertising in it, and that they can sell inclusion in that brochure to acts. And there it starts to become a bit muddy, doesn't it? Because if you exist to facilitate lots and lots of individuals, and Christ, as I said, I don't envy anyone the job, because talk about herding cats. I will now talk about herding cats. I imagine they're difficult to herd, but I have no experience, and maybe there's a knack. The point is that it becomes muddy, doesn't it? Because you have certain expectations. You get all of these people together. We need people to facilitate this, otherwise it's chaos. I get that. It's not dissimilar to what happens on the street with the street performers. All the street performers zoom into town, they fly pitch, they do shows all over the place. That creates a crowd blockage problem. The police come in, they shut everyone down. So then the fringe goes, well, we like having street performers because we take pictures of them and put them on all the advertising that we sell adverts next to. That's like the face of the fringe. So then you think to yourselves, okay, well, in that case, there has to be street performing, so we have to regulate it, otherwise it becomes unmanageable and chaotic and people fly pitch against each other and everyone turns their amps up and turns the volume up and the whole thing gets shut down. So then you've got a situation where it's like, you know, humans and the police. No one likes the police. Some people like the police. But without the police, it's chaos. So then you've got to have, oh, well, now we've got this weird kind of tension between the concept of it, you know, I mean, there are anarchists, I'm sure, who listens to this, and I know anarchy isn't synonymous with chaos, but my point is that you end up with, you know, people are going to behave like people, which means loads of them will ignore the rules, not know about the rules, not pay attention, what have you, or actively rebel against the rules. So if you need to manage those people such that everyone is safe, you need some sort of management, and then there will be tension between people and management. So as it is with humans and the police, as it is with street performers and the management now, which is better than ever, thanks to the sensible banding together of the street performance community under the auspices of several individual humans who I won't name so as not to embarrass the ones I can't remember. But they've done brilliantly this year, better than ever, and comedy needs an equivalent body, except that there are so many of us, how is that manageable? So then you have the LCA and you go, yeah, great, the Live Comedy Association, this is exactly what they should do, represent everybody. Presumably when the LCA gets big enough, there will then be a tension between, I'm sure there already is tension between the individual comics represented by the LCA and the LCA itself, and it just goes on, doesn't it? It goes on. So if you had 10 people got together and said, let's have a little festival, one of us can be in charge of it, that would become difficult. So they go, let's have more of us in charge of it. More acts would join. If it was successful, then you've got thousands of acts, 50 people in charge of it. No one likes the decisions they make, and it's all just the fucking end of the South Park Walmart episode, isn't it? I'm not saying there's no solution. What I'm saying is, in the face, this is what I was talking about, in the Facebook group of this podcast, there's a really fascinating argument going on inside a respectful discussion going on inside the Facebook group about exactly, you know, the whys and wherefores of how long it takes to produce an app, whether the website is mobile friendly enough that it doesn't need an app, whether people were promised an app or not, whether people, having been promised an app, deserve one, or whether actually it's fit enough for purpose, or whether the outrage of a huge community of people is sufficient that it sort of doesn't matter anymore, or whether it's simply about messaging. It's all absolutely fascinating. So I look forward to your opinions on that. I have to say, I think that even though I had a big, powerful, oh Christ, how are people going to sell tickets? This is awful. I think we will get by if we can be bothered to learn the now and near function on the website, which is available from your mobile browser. It's not brilliant. I don't know how I feel about it. There was no nothing last year, and that was a problem. I don't know how I feel about it. I feel distressed, and I feel like it must be impossible to manage the situation to everyone's satisfaction. And I just feel like it's about the messaging, isn't it? If you are trying to herd thousands of cats, you've at least got to be open with them and tell them the challenges that you're having as and when you're having them. Otherwise, you end up... I mean, there are people on Twitter saying, I'm going to take the fringe organisation to court because I paid 400 quid for an app and I'm not on the app. And I see their point. So I don't even know. I don't know how big organisations work. I don't know what's a decent standard to which to hold people. But I do think that if you're going to facilitate thousands of artists, you need to tell them what you're doing. Well, all of this, a fascinatingly lukewarm take, given that by the time you hear this, it will have been out for weeks. And I may well get in touch with Nathan in the next fortnight and say, let's bin this. But there we go, some thoughts. Basically, I feel that it all boils down to the end of the Walmart episode of South Park. And if you don't know what that means, look it up on the YouTubes.